Welcome to the County Conversations Podcast, brought to you by the Florida Association of Counties Institute for County Government, with support from the University of Florida's IFAS. In this podcast, we dive deep into the diverse and dynamic world of Florida's counties with engaging interviews and thought-provoking conversations surrounding the challenges as well as successes of Florida's counties. Each episode brings you firsthand perspectives from county commissioners, government officials, community leaders, and subject matter experts who are shaping the future of our state. We explore a wide range of topics from economic development and public safety to environmental conservation and emerging technologies. Our aim here is to provide a platform for knowledge sharing, collaboration, and inspiration for county officials and residents alike. Whether you're a county commissioner, government professional, or simply interested in understanding the local government landscape, we hope this podcast provides valuable insights and practical takeaways on all things counties.
Okay, all right. Welcome to another edition of County Conversations Podcast. I'm pleased to introduce and welcome back Whit Blanton. He is the current president of the Florida chapter of the American Planning Association. His full-time job is executive director of Ford Pinellas, and he's actually been a guest instructor here at ICG, developing and delivering our Transportation Planning 101 course. So, Whit, welcome back to the studio.
Thank you for having me.
All right. So one thing you probably didn't get to do in in-depth when you recorded the class was talk about yourself. So can you give us some biographic information, where you're from, how'd you get into planning, what's your favorite baseball team?
Well, I'm originally from North Carolina and moved down to Florida in 1971 with my mother and sisters. And so I've been a Florida resident pretty much since that time. And I got into planning because I was a journalism student at the University of Florida and was interested in the legislative process.
Let's pull that up a little bit closer to your mouth. There you go.
I was interested in the legislative process, so I was accepted into the legislative intern program and worked with the House K-12 committee. And as I was getting that job, they told me I had to be in grad school. So I applied to the Urban and Regional Planning Program at Florida State and didn't take a single transportation planning class, but left there as a transportation planner, took a job in Orlando as a consultant, and did that for about 27 years. And then 8 years ago, last week, I became the executive director at Ford Pinellas, where we do countywide transportation and countywide land use planning.
So how did you get into transportation? Because that is something, I didn't study transportation planning, but it is something that has followed me through my career for better or for worse.
It was the best paying job offer at the time. And I think it was just a recognition that under growth management in the mid-80s, late-80s, that transportation was probably the biggest challenge that counties and local governments were facing. And so there was a lot of demand for that. And the job was in Orlando compared to the other two jobs, which were in other parts of the state. And I knew Orlando, and I was comfortable relocating to Orlando. And that's where we raised our family. And now I'm a Tampa Bay resident.
All right. Let's talk a little bit about the planning profession. It's always a challenge to tell people what planning is. But if you look at like a local comp plan, it really covers just a little bit of everything from transportation, land use, infrastructure, parks and recreation, and so on and so on. And so really at a local level, the reach of county planning touches just about everything that a county, you know, that a county does. So what is your kind of elevator speech? I know you're a transportation planner, but what is your elevator speech just on describing what the planning profession is?
Well, I really believe that planning is about seeing the connections in things and really drawing that linkage between actions and outcomes. And everything is a factor that influences that. So we don't directly deal in a lot of ways with the education system, although we do have school planners. But education, economic development, all of those, infrastructure, are all big determinants of how a community grows and how a community evolves. And planners have a huge say in all of those things because we are the dot connectors for the community. And more importantly, not only are we looking at things as they are today, but we're really trying to think about where we're going to be in 20 to 25 years. And there's that old Wayne Gretzky quote, which is, don't skate to the puck, skate to where the puck will be. So one of our challenges is trying to figure out where the puck will be in each of our communities and trying to position ourselves for good decisions in that 5 to 10 to 20 year time frame.
Well, let's stay with that theme. I mean, you are the current president of Florida APA. Are there things that the organization are looking at to address sort of what's coming down? What's the next thing? I know resiliency is big, but what else?
I think a lot of it is our future workforce. That is something that we are really starting to take seriously because we need a pipeline of not only people in the planning profession, but in all of our industries across Florida that can replace those workers who are aging out. And a lot of that comes to quality of life and quality of community because we need to attract those workers to the places that we need them to be. And that means providing housing. It means having a good educational system in place. Providing the infrastructure that's going to meet the needs. We're, again, growing at greater than 1,000 people, you know, a week. And that growth is like it was in the 80s. And we had pretty robust growth management back in the 80s. Now we have a very different framework for how we deal with that. So a lot of onus is still on the communities and less so on the state. So there's nobody really out there bailing you out.
So we talked before we started about some of the changes that Florida has seen in growth management. So for the folks that don't know, 1985 was the landmark Growth Management Act for the state of Florida, and really stayed unchanged until about 2000. And well, there was a big change in 2004, I think, under Jeb Bush, where we had school concurrency and a lot of other changes. They quickly flipped that around in about 2 years after that. But the real big change came in 2011 with the Community Planning Act and some subsequent revisions a couple of years after that. So, yeah, the state is growing. It seems like more oversight would be needed. But how do you think counties are managing this growth? Are the changes good or are they bad?
Well, I'm in favor generally of growth. I think growth is a good thing because what it enables you to do is adapt and evolve as a community, and you don't want to be stagnant, you don't want to be stuck. So you're either growing or you're dying is something that some people have said, and I tend to believe that. But growth needs to be done in a way that fits the character of a place, that reinforces the ideals and values that a community has. And that takes really a good understanding of what's driving that and how it can best be complemented and support with good decision-making, good investments. I think the big difference between now and, say, before 2011 is that you have much less state oversight and state direction being provided to local governments about how they manage growth. Also, growth that is affecting multiple jurisdictions, multiple counties, regional impacts. We have a less prescriptive way of dealing with that now. So it really depends on partnerships that are developed locally, that are sustained through getting to know people and working collaboratively. And that is very different because it used to be mandated and now it's more voluntary.
So I always viewed the state role in growth management as a little burdensome in as much as that whenever a comp plan amendment were to be submitted to Department of Community Affairs, that they're always looking for the gotcha, that there was something in this or that. That issue I always had a problem with. What the big role I thought that they played well in was dealing with what you were referring to, the extra jurisdictional impacts.
Right.
And with the changes with the Community Planning Act and the fading away of DRIs, are you seeing or members of FAPA seeing a negative impact with respect to that? So it's not that my county does anything wrong. I'm worried about my neighbor who's going to do something wrong and impact me.
I think that happens in different parts of the state. You know, what's different, and I agree with you, I think the state had a pretty heavy hand, too much so. What the state did well was bringing everybody up to a basic minimum level of planning and assuring that they're meeting the requirements of the laws. But that wasn't a very good approach in every county, because you had places like Orange County and Pinellas County and many other, Broward County, many other counties that had a very advanced level of planning and infrastructure financing, and they knew what they were doing, and they were being very strategic about guiding growth and density and development in the right locations, and the state was in some cases inhibiting that. It wasn't allowing them to be who they were. And in Pinellas County in particular, is a highly developed county without a lot of vacant land. We needed to build up, and we didn't need to be told that you can't build up because some of your roads are at level of service F. You know, we needed to have some flexibility. That did eventually come later. So I think now where the state stood in there and made those changes and forced those kinds of regional extra jurisdictional analyses, it's still happening, but it's happening in different ways. Largely, the Florida Department of Transportation is now doing that kind of work. And they're doing it in cooperation with local governments, because the local governments know that they need the DOT there to be able to provide the roads and whatever other infrastructure is necessary. And these agencies have just recognized that if they don't get ahead of it, then they're always going to be behind the eight ball trying to overcome, you know, whatever gridlock that they've allowed to happen. And it's interesting, as planners and APA Florida, we like working with agencies like FDOT, because their mission is not necessarily to tell you what to do with your land use, but they have to react to it, and they have to be mindful of the land use decisions that are being made at the local level. So we think that there's an opportunity to provide training and guidance and work with our local governments to really be intentional and understand what the Department of Transportation is looking for instance, and how local governments can help prepare so that nobody's caught flat-footed, but we're thinking about what that growth and redevelopment looks like in the future.
So you mentioned transport. How is transportation, I want to say oversight regulation, how has that changed over time? Because you just mentioned, you know, Pinellas needed to grow, what, you know, build up, and if you hit the threshold on a level of service, you go from D to E, or suddenly you're stopped, which is right. Ridiculous. So,
well, in the past, that would stop your development permit if you didn't have the capacity on the roads to develop and couldn't get it in place in the next 3 to 5 years, you were dead in the water over a failing road. We had US 19 in Pinellas County was level of service F, and the state essentially forced Pinellas County to build some parallel roads to relieve US 19. That was the strategy in the 80s and 90s, and we're very thankful, frankly, that that happened. Lately, what the state has done is broaden the flexibility of how funds can be used. So they haven't created necessarily more money and more programs, but they've created more flexibility within those programs by allowing district dedicated revenue and some of these other sources go towards transit in the right location. That makes good sense as a solution. It probably doesn't make sense everywhere. But that flexibility is really helpful to counties like Broward County and Miami-Dade and Palm Beach County and Pinellas County, where building more roads is probably not as much of an option as it might be in Sumter County or a place like that.
Yeah, I was going to ask, you know, some of these multimodal solutions look good on paper, and it helps you get a development order or a permit. I mean, is your experience in transportation planning that some of those actually do work, or they work as well as what we've done in the past?
Well, I think they can, and they do, but you know, you really need a really good land use plan. You really need to think about housing and where people are going to live and how they're going to get places. Technology has come a long way to help with the first mile, last mile, in terms of the electric scooters, the electric bikes, the bike share programs. That wasn't really on the radar 10, 15 years ago, and now they're ubiquitous in urban areas. So creating those kinds of mechanisms helps reduce some of the pressure on the transportation network. It's just so expensive to build roads. It's expensive to build trains. You know, it's expensive to build transportation, period. So as much of that as that we can use the existing system more efficiently and using technology, adaptive traffic signals, giving more green time where you need to give the green time, that helps. That goes a long way. Where planners really play a role is that if you aren't thinking about land use and housing as part of your transportation policy, you're probably only picking up about a third or half of what's influencing your transportation decisions. We live in a county where housing is really expensive, and that's forcing people to move an hour or so out to live in Hernando County or Pasco County or someplace like that, and the job is still in Pinellas. And that puts a lot of pressure on the road network. With technology, though, people are able to work from home, and that working from home is changing the dynamic. It's changing how people travel, when they travel, how many days they have to go into the office. But it's not necessarily changing how many times they need to go to the grocery store or go to daycare or take their kids to a ball game. Yeah. So we still have all that traffic out on the roads. And in fact, in the afternoon peak hour, it's well above what it used to be in 2019, 2018. It's that morning commute that's probably a little easier for everybody.
Yeah, I would agree with you. The traffic, I mean, even though we have flexible schedule here, you're right. I see, you know, the same amount of traffic coming in on, you know, Wednesday that I do on Monday.
Right.
Have you visited Miami-Dade, where they've done on their rail corridor and their building at their stops, high density with a requirement for workforce housing in those? And I was down there probably 8 months ago and did a tour with two of the county commissioners. I just thought that was a community that was doing it right.
Right. Well, they've had to. You know, Miami-Dade has really had to build around the next type of infrastructure, and their smart corridor plan envisions that the future of getting around Miami-Dade is going to be increasingly on transit in multiple corridors and multiple types of ways. Brightline is just one of those. Brightline's whole business model is real estate development. That's how they're generating their revenue. It's not fare prices. And that is transit-oriented development, essentially. It's building around those stations, creating housing, retail space, office space. And that's increasingly more accessible to a bigger group of the population. We're planning for it in Pinellas County on our Sunrunner bus rapid transit line. And those station areas is where we expect to build up. And, you know, the thing that development really is painfully aware is the expensive cost of parking. So, you know, we're really looking at walkable communities in those areas, because if you're trying to accommodate everybody driving there, you're going to ruin your pro forma by spending $20,000 or more per parking space. Imagine what a 600 space parking garage is going to cost you as part of your development. That has to be absorbed somewhere in your rents. Mm-hmm. And it just drives the cost of everything upwards. So being mindful about parking and parking management is another aspect where planners can play a role in shaping how development occurs.
You mentioned technology and how to use the system more efficiently, and you're a transportation planner, so you weren't anticipating scooters. I don't think anybody was. I know some people were thinking about, you know, smart vehicles, autonomous vehicles. Dr. Chapin at FSU had written a report for DOT on that subject and how it will affect the layout of certain types of commercial development. Are planners looking at that on your end, on all of this new technology and what's kind of coming over the horizon?
We are. We're thinking about it in a lot of different ways. Technology includes autonomous vehicles, and, you know, even my car has adaptive,
the lane change?
It has the lane change, but it's cruise control, adaptive cruise control. And I'm driving a rental car that doesn't have it. And I find myself driving up on the bumper of somebody, and it's really nice to have. A lot of that is going to play a big role in safety. And having the in-vehicle technology that will alert you of a bicyclist up ahead, or if you're a bicyclist, of a car coming behind you that's within the 3 feet space of where, you know, they need to get out of your way, and it might give you a heads up that that car is encroaching on your space. So technology is there. It's a matter of making it affordable. Most people experience technology with the cameras that adapt the traffic signals in response to congestion and provide more green time. But we're using it on buses to give buses preferential treatment at intersections to get them through the queue faster. We're using it to locate the scooter and the e-bike corral that's near you. And then also having that curb space is another area where technology is providing the ability for pickup and drop-off zones for Uber and Lyft and those kinds of those kinds of companies that get you around. And it's definitely changing how the built environment is coming out of the ground.
Yeah, it's exciting. And I think safety, for me, that's the most important piece of the technology. I mean, I've been in a rental car that's got a lot of what you just talked about. And I'm like, I never would have seen this car coming up on my left had it not been for that. Well, as we kind of wrap up, I wanted to talk about the diversity of the state. You represent an organization which has how many local chapters?
Well, we have 12 sections. 3,000 planners in the state of Florida that we represent. And those are public and private planners.
So we've got 67 counties, 400-plus cities. We have 30 coastal counties, I believe. Among those, I think there's 29 to 31 fiscally constrained counties. So we've got the needs of a Broward to Miami-Dade from a planning perspective are much different than Calhoun and Liberty. And I'm sure that they'll match the resource with the need down in Miami-Dade. So they need to invest a lot in their planning, whereas maybe Calhoun and Liberty and Washington doesn't have to. But doesn't mean that those smaller counties don't have some big challenges. So what do you hear from some of the members that are in the planning field that represent some of the smaller counties in Florida? What are their challenges and needs?
I think a lot of it is there's still a fair amount of growth happening even in those smaller counties. And the scale of growth is a little bit bigger because there's fewer people there. So adding 4,000 more people to some of these smaller counties and communities in a year, that's a pretty big impact. A lot of it is that whole workforce thing that I talked about is helping people understand where they can get some skills training, job training opportunities. The economy in a lot of those smaller counties also tends to be weaker because they depend on certain types of jobs that are relatively low paying in the correction institutions and farming communities. And so having a workforce there that can sustain those economies is something that planners pay a lot of attention to. We also pay a lot of attention to code enforcement, basic development permitting, and then making sure that there's water supply and things like that are available. So, you know, planners review those permits, approve those permits, and make sure that the infrastructure is available. It just may not be sized at a level that you have it in the urban areas. And they may not feel the same pressure, but everybody wants to see some economic growth and economic development for the people who live there. And that's a matter of matching the skills and the opportunity with what the public's ready to support, willing to support.
It's interesting what you've been talking about since we started is when I used to be a planner a long, long time ago, it was very rigid, it was very prescriptive, and it was hard to see what the overall goal was, right? We would, you know, we were focused on concurrency, whether it's for roads or for water. But I did have a mentor at the time who had an economics background. He said, you know, good planning is good economic development, right? And so it just seems that what you're talking about is more of what planning is supposed to be. It's supposed to help economic development, provide housing, training. And that's really, I mean, am I right? Like 20 years ago, we weren't talking about that because everything was so prescriptive, so rigid.
Right.
And it's a lot different now. And anyway, it's refreshing to hear you say that.
I think every community needs to have a vision of itself and what they want to become over time. And There is no luck. Luck to me is preparation meeting opportunity. So being prepared for what the future that you want to be, and really thinking what kinds of investments may be needed to achieve that future, what kind of preservation tactics may be needed. There's a lot of small towns in Florida that have great character, and they are places where proud people live, and they want to raise their children there and want to go back there and visit and have those family gatherings there. Well, there's a preservation aspect to that. But preservation doesn't mean do nothing. Preservation means integrating new development in with the old and making it fit that character and fit that scale. And that's an issue whether you're Miami or whether you're Freeport.
All right.
Frankly.
Excellent. I know I said we were wrapping up, but I did want to talk about briefly, because we're in hurricane season. I'm dressed like this because I'm going, it's a travel day for my conference. On Thursday, I have Craig Fugate, former state DEM director and FEMA director, coming to speak to our leadership class. So, you know, last year we saw a devastating hurricane hit southwest Florida, Ian, and more recently we've seen flooding in Broward County, which was so unusual, given that I didn't know there was much rain going on at the time, and then we've had some tornadoes over in Escambia County. But increasingly, I've seen planning playing kind of a more integrated role in this whole disaster preparedness, mm-hmm. mitigation, recovery. We can talk about resilience till the, you know, forever. But how do you see the role of planners evolving into this field of preparedness?
Well, and I have a responsibility in my county that I have to be ready in the EEOC whenever storm threatens. I think there's two areas broadly where planners play a role. One is in mitigation. The other is adaptation. And it's really making sure that as we're building communities that we are adapting to the increasing risk of these more violent storms that are happening. And we've seen the evidence, whether it was Michael a few years ago or Ian, these storms just pull up out of nowhere sometimes and they move at an incredibly fast pace. Or if they don't move at a fast pace, you don't know where they're going to go, because we sure thought Ian was coming to St. Petersburg, Clearwater. And so I think the trend for planners now is to move more towards an adaptation approach, so that we're looking out for the coastal high hazard areas. And if we're allowing development in the coastal high hazard area, we're mitigating that impact by building more shelter space, or we're making them adhere to a code that's going to address a Category 4 wind event and looking at the storm surge effect. And you know, it's going to have a different effect on every community, but being able to identify your most vulnerable physical assets and prioritizing what gets rebuilt and stood back up as quickly as possible, because they're the linchpins to your economy, or they're the connection for services to come in and out of your community. That's really the job of the planner right now, is looking at those priorities from a physical asset standpoint, and where do we need to make sure we're ready to go if there's damage to that physical asset, just like the Sanibel Bridge that was put back up in a matter of days by Florida DOT. There's a lot you can do with emergency powers.
Absolutely.
But you need to know what you need to focus on and which ones need to be priorities. In Pinellas County, we've identified two major roadways that if we get a certain type of storm event, that's going to be a focus of rebuilding, because they are the lifeblood of our economy. And not just the tourist economy. Those tourists will come back in time, but the workforce that really needs to get you back up and running.
Yeah, I mean, Bay County and Panama City had suffered from that. They were, because of the housing stock was so damaged and destroyed, they couldn't even get builders in there
for
a very long time. At the planning role, you talk about adaptation. So are you seeing an integration of some of the vulnerability assessments that are kind of being done over in the emergency management area? Are you seeing those getting integrated into some of the land use and decisions that, you know, maybe again 30 years ago that really wasn't done, other than what you mentioned. We know the coastal high hazard area is important, you can do things there, but some of the vulnerability assessments weren't necessarily being done, or if they were done, they were siloed over with the EM director.
That's right. There has been a lot of pushback because there's an economic aspect of all of this. Sizing your pipes and building your walls a little thicker and making sure your windows are in place that are a certain quality, all that drives up cost. Raising the building, things like that, all add economic impact to the bottom line. So we have to really be mindful about that. But yeah, I do see that those discussions are much more robust. They're much more carried through, less stovepipe than they used to be. It still is somewhat of a case-by-case decision, although in some communities it's stronger than in others. So there isn't a one-size-fits-all yet. But these are areas where we're still evolving and learning how to apply some of these new approaches and new techniques. And it's going to take some time, but I hope we don't have to do a big wake-up call and that we've learned our lessons from Ian and these other storms, that we need to be prepared and we need to be mindful of taking those evacuation orders seriously, too. That was another serious wake-up call.
Totally agree. That was scary. Ian was scary. You guys missed the bullet. But maybe, you know, after every storm, there's a lot of lessons learned that come out of those.
There are,
so,
yeah.
Hopefully we'll, you know, we'll be able to learn from those. So lastly, for whether it's a new county commissioner or a veteran county commissioner, is there one or two things that you think they should know that would help them and help the planner that works for them?
Well, I would say that the planner in your planning department has a good handle on where the growth is likely to happen and what type of growth is likely to happen. We're not going to get it 100% right. You know, nobody can predict the future 100%, but we have a really good sense of what the inventory, what the stock is, what the market demand is likely to be. Planners in every community are talking all the time to people who are bringing ideas. How would you react if I told you I was going to do this? And they hear all those things. And a lot of times those projects don't come to fruition, but that knowledge is gold and it really is important. So I would say talk to your planner, talk to your planning director, go to lunch and just touch base every couple of months, because you'll hear some things, you'll get some insights into what's happening in the community that you'll be able to kind of put in your back pocket and maybe pull out when you need it. But those little kernels of wisdom and information, little data points, I think can really help ground a decision and put some context to something that may be coming up before you.
Good. They should also take the ICG Planning and Growth Management class and your transportation class 101 for local officials that you did. All right, Whit, thank you so much for coming back to our studio, and hopefully we can host you again, or we'll come down to your camp.
Excellent. Happy to do it anytime.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.